Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me is my co-host, Sir Chad Riley.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hello, part two.
Yes, we are continuing our series from last week where we talked about the illustrious Tim Burton, and we will be continuing that conversation today alongside a special guest. You've heard her voice on the show before, and she is returning to give her input on the conversation, Miss Hannah Porter.
Hello, everyone.
That wasn't loud enough. You gotta do it louder.
Hello. It'd be like you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
You got a little weird inflection.
Exactly. You have to, hello, kind of deal.
Okay, great.
So, but no, we got a great show in store for you guys, and of course, we're gonna have some fun. But even when we're not wearing guy liner and layers of patchwork clothing, The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. This is why I have to proofread whatever Chad writes in the script. I'll write the script out, and then I just happened to, right before we were starting the show, like seconds before, I'm like, wait, what is this? And then the show started, and I'm like, oh, I gotta read this now. Cause
yeah, you got no choice.
Yeah, and I'm like, what?
Only what I left you with.
So yeah,
we're talking about Burton.
Yeah,
I don't know if there's any single director who has more like men in makeup and like people in layers and layers of weird clothing in his films than Tim Burton.
Yeah.
I challenge you to find somebody who does it more.
Do us a favor and take a minute to subscribe to the Filmlosophers podcast on your favorite platforms. New episodes are available every week on Player FM, Google Play, iTunes, Audioboom, Libsyn, and Stitcher. If once a week simply isn't enough for you, class is always in session on social media. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to connect with other Filmlosophy fans and discuss movie news all week long. Finally, for more episodes and access to other VGB content, Studio Network, other VGB Studios Network podcasts, visit VGBstudios.com.
This is what happens when we trust you.
See, this is what happens when, see, I, man, you know, whatever.
Here, don't worry, I'll change it.
Yeah, there's other stuff on the web. There's other things. Oh,
VGBstudios.com.
VGBstudios.com.
There's lots of stuff to listen to. It's great.
There is. And you know what? We got a great conversation in store. Man, I am not having a stroke, I promise people. But how about
but you are having trouble with
I'm
your
having
words.
Trouble saying yeah. words for some reason. But you know what? Let's just
That's awkward
power
when
forward.
Our only mode of communication is words.
It is. You
this
know
is
what?
A podcast after
this
all.
This is. I'm going to go. See you guys.
Oh, boy.
Now, all right. Let's go and jump into some movie news. And with movie news, we got some actual great content to go over as far as the trailer smorgasbord that has just downpoured over the last couple of weeks. So we've actually had, I think, more trailers in the last 2 weeks debut than probably over the course of the entire month. Although we didn't get a chance to talk about it last week, one of the ones that really did come up that we actually were impressed with was the new Rogue One trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And many other large films have released trailers also that have got people buzzing, including Logan, the third part in the Wolverine series, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, The Boss Baby, A Cure for Wellness, and Shia LaBeouf's latest film, Man Down. I got a chance to... Well, we all
Assassin's
had a chance...
Assassin's Creed also did a second trailer.
That's true.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah. We had a chance to see a lot of these trailers at the house. Hannah was telling us that she got a chance to see some of them. Just off the cuff, any of these stand out to any of you guys right now? Like, just from what you've seen out of these... trailers.
As far as the trailers themselves or the movies that they represent?
We're just totally basing it off of trailers.
Trailers themselves. Well, I mean, the Rogue One, like you mentioned, that's my next favorite movie. That's my next obsession once it finally comes out in theaters. I think it looks amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Even the trailer on its own looks amazing, but I think the movie's going to be as good as the trailers, which sometimes you don't get that. Sometimes trailers are so good, yeah, and then the movies are worse than what they pitched to you.
What about you, Hannah?
I would agree with Rogue One, but I'm also really excited for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And something that really stood out to me was I love how they use music in their mm-hmm. trailers. Obviously, they're really well known for their throwback mixtapes. Mm-hmm. And that's what they used to highlight really awesome action scenes. And that's a rare combination, and they did it really well. And I loved the first movie, and I'm excited for the second one.
And speaking of music, one of the ones, since we're talking about the trailers that, you know, really got us going, I have to say, I'm really, really digging the new Logan trailer. Although mm-hmm. it's simplistic in the way it looked, the way the music actually works with it, I think it actually looks really good. In fact, I think it actually will be one of the better Marvel films as far as on that side of Fox.
Yeah, I think for that particular franchise, they've definitely done a major turnaround from where the Wolverine subset of the franchise started with Origins, which was kind of universally panned. And to see the recovery that they made over not just Wolverine movies, but other X-Men films. And now you've got kind of this capstone to Hugh Jackman's run as the character. You know, that's pretty exciting that they've gone so far. I mean, it's depressing.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. I mean, it was really depressing to watch, especially the part that Patrick Stewart seems to be playing where he's, I mean, still invalid Professor Xavier, like lying on a bed in a grain silo that's mm-hmm. toppled over. I mean, just really how the mighty have fallen. I mean, yeah, he had a mansion and lots of money to help other people with, and now he's just in this zone. But I think it really does. There's some artistry that's very kind of overly present in the way that the visuals are stylized for the trailer. Yeah. That is a vast improvement over where that franchise started.
Yeah, certainly. And those are the types of things, those are the types of contrasts that really stand out for a film like this. Had they come out with a third Wolverine trailer that looked just like the first two, I mean, you're not really giving fans anything brand new. You're not giving them anything. Obviously, the formula works for certain people because they keep bringing in money, so they're making a third film, obviously. Sure. But when you do something so unique, so off the cuff for this type of franchise, specifically for this, the only time I'd ever seen something similar to this was when the Captain America trailer came out. And that mm-hmm. one had a lot more. That one had the same type of added seriousness to the overall situation. So it gave a more stronger interest in the story as opposed to the action, which is something that not many times you get with, and I'm not saying that this is what it is, but like the mass production type films, mass produced films that just keep getting knocked out one after another. Not that Marvel is doing that, but
the major franchises.
Exactly. Yeah. The ones that just constantly are popping out, you know, films like that. So
sure,
to see something different, especially with Wolverine, it's, you know, it's powerful. It's something that really makes sense for a lot of people to say, hey, they're trying something new, why not give it a shot?
Well, and to know that it's going to be the end of the line. You know, yeah, like, so often the thing that I love about comic books in general is the episodic nature, where it never really ends, and especially in comic books, you've got characters will die, but then they'll come back, and, you know, yeah, it's no big deal. But you've had for several years now, you know, Hugh Jackman confirming that this is his last stint as Wolverine. So yeah, you see this kind of far down the road in the life of that character and others. I mean, his healing factor has deteriorated to the point that he's got scars that, you know, have healed over but not gone away.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of a sense of some, you know, final big push and then some sense of hopefully closure.
And another trailer that I wanted to talk about, which actually debuted today, interestingly enough, the last time I got a chance to be on the Video Game Bang weekend show, we talked about Shia LaBeouf's role as far as him not doing so great as an actor, him not really finding great films to do. And the latest trailer that he's in, which is Man Down, it looks like it's a military. It looks like it focuses a little bit more on the veteran aspect of most military men after they go home, the kind of, you know, refocusing of their life, trying to make sense of a lot of things. I think this film, from what the trailer shows, this film could be that role that Shia LaBeouf's been waiting for to really kind of shine above most other things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember the thing that always challenges me with Shia LaBeouf is his notoriety, and not in a good way, in like the real world. It's hard to see the character through the infamy of the performer sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to see like a likable character, let's say like Julia Roberts in her heyday.
Mm.
It's hard to see the character that she's playing because she's Julia Roberts and you're very familiar with her. In a less appealing way, in many cases, Shia LaBeouf has kind of made a name for himself and kind of left a sour taste in the mouths of a lot of people. And so it's difficult. I remember seeing the movie Fury, which is the tank Brad Pitt and Shia LaBeouf is part of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
He has a really interesting, unique role that's different from anything that I'd seen him in before, and he does the part really, really well. And still, it's very difficult to see the character through the actor. And this is in a movie with somebody of the stature of Brad Pitt, where you can sort of at times see the character in spite of Brad Pitt's notoriety. But with Shia LaBeouf, I think it just works a little differently because it's not, he's not always been appealing.
Yeah.
You know, in his public persona in the world itself. This trailer was phenomenal. You know, talk about using musical cues and whatnot, and giving you hints of things that are in the movie without giving the whole game away. And, you know, it's a story of a soldier who's returned and is dealing with PTSD and is trying to process something that happened while he was overseas on deployment. So, you know, it looks like it's going to be a really, really compelling film. I don't know. I might personally still have that challenge of not seeing how good his performance is because it's Shia LaBeouf giving the performance.
What do you think, Hannah? Can you see a person's performance past the persona they've created with themselves outside of the Hollywood stage?
Yeah, I think it, to Chad's point, that it can be really difficult sometimes. Take a look at, you know, Lindsay Lohan, or in a musical aspect, Britney Spears, and or even like the Olsen twins, people that have kind of fallen off or they've had extreme mental breakdowns in public eye, it can be really hard to kind of see past that, like what you were saying, or take a Justin Bieber and all of his many fallouts.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, I think depending on how good their art and their craft is, then it's easier to see past that. When they are really talented at getting into the character and getting into the story and really making you believe what they are selling and giving you, it's a little bit easier to get past that. But I think it depends on the perspective that each person goes in with as well.
Very true. Well, speaking of new clips, Dwayne The Rock Johnson is actually singing in the new Moana clip that has been released by Disney. So Disney released a new clip from their upcoming computer animated film Moana, and the clip features the musical talents of Johnson as he sings a tune celebrating his own achievements in a song that is both catchy yet egotistical.
It's perfect for him.
It really is. Chad saw the clip earlier before we came here, and I saw the clip earlier today, and it really is a catchy song. It's pretty much him singing about how she doesn't have to thank him, even though he's done all these great things. He knows he's done it. He's great. He's awesome. And he just wants her to know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a different play, like in the animated film Hercules, where you've got the muses who sing about all the amazing deeds of Hercules. Well, this character, Maui, he's actually going to go ahead and sing it about himself.
He doesn't have any muses, so he's going
to
do it himself.
I mean, the song is called You're Welcome. And he's just like going through and saying, you're welcome for doing this, for doing that. But I mean, what got me is that it was really hard to believe the animated character singing because it was The Rock's voice.
Yeah.
And I was really distracted by the fact that The Rock was singing.
Plus, he was singing really well.
Like, you know, they have auto-tuning and all that.
You
kind
know,
of stuff, so they can
either
figure
way
that out. But yeah, it sounded good.
He's sung by himself in other films that he's, you know, made and whatnot. And hey, the guy can sing. I'll admit, the guy can probably sing better than mostly everybody here in this room.
Whoa.
Minus Hannah.
Whoa.
Minus Hannah.
Wow.
Hannah can sing.
Jeez.
But it's okay.
I mean, you know,
I'm going to apologize for the bus that he just ran you over
that's
with.
That's all right. I'll take it. Cause
that's
I
no
haven't,
way to treat a
I
guest.
I haven't heard The Rock sing, so he might fully be like amazing, and
see?
I just don't know it. So,
Moana starring Ali Cravallo and Dwayne Johnson is a tale of an adventurous teenager who, as she sails out on a daring mission to save her people, meets the once mighty demigod Maui. Together, they sail across the open ocean on an action-packed voyage, encountering enormous monsters and impossible odds. Speaking of clips, The Nightmare Before Christmas got an honest trailer. So if most of you know, here on the show, we talk a lot about honest trailers. That's one of the things that we really like to go over with, just because of the fact that the guy who does the honest trailers movie voice was so gracious enough to do our opening for our show. So we try to keep up with a lot of what they do and let you guys know about what they do sometimes. So a big part of this year, this time of the year, is that you get a lot of horror and Halloween-themed movies. And among them is the 1992's Nightmare Before Christmas. So, of course, because of that, lo and behold, Honest Trailers released one off of the movie.
Can I just say I was really happy to watch this Honest Trailer because it validated something about me. Last week, we talked about Tim Burton's stop motion animation films and his influence in that genre of film. And when we were doing research for the show, I mean, there was this huge wake up moment of, wait a minute, The Nightmare Before Christmas is not directed by Tim Burton.
Mm-mm.
It's Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, but he was a producer and he consulted behind the scenes, but he didn't direct the thing.
No.
And that was a shock. I'd never dove that deep to see.
Yeah. Well, essentially, you know. it's the film.
So they call it out in the honest trailer.
The film is actually based on a story that Tim Burton had written a while back. So they obviously upped it up and did whatever to it and screenplays and writing and whatnot. But it's apparently based on a story that he wrote long ago, previous to the film.
Well, and he was busy with another film that we're going to talk about, so he couldn't switch gears and do this, so they subbed in another director. But
if you want to catch a glimpse of that trailer, we'll actually be posting it on our Facebook page, so you can get all the lovely funny stuff that they poke fun at and have a grand time with. So
as usual, they're fun guys.
But that does transition us over into our special presentation of Octoburtonfest. Yes, we are celebrating the legacy of The Weird and Wonderful Part 2. As we've stated last week in Part 1 of this special series, there has been several filmmakers in the industry that have made a pronounced impact in cinema, but none have made a greater contribution to the genre of weird than the unique filmmaker Tim Burton. As we continue our special two-part series, we'll continue the celebration of the auteur's exquisite touch in film with this week's episode focusing on his live-action films.
Yeah, so last week we focused on stop motion, like mentioned a couple seconds ago, and now we're going to talk about live action.
Yes. This
with
sound.
With that triumphant swell.
I was like, that was great. So last week, like Chad said, we took that in-depth look, but this week we're going to go ahead and flip the script a little bit and jump on the other side of Burton's portfolio of oddities and examine the live-action films that have given us a deeper look at the creative genius's thought process. So many people know Tim Burton for his stop motion. Like we said, Nightmare Before Christmas. Tim Burton Presents, or however, Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, that seems to be one of the more popular ones. A lot more people who grew up in the 80s remember Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. You remember even the more, like, I guess this generation type people would know, like, Frankenweenie. They would know Corpse Bride, which is another one, the other two we talked about last week.
Sure.
But we're going to kind of dig in a bit and dive into a little bit more of the obscure films that you may not know, you may know, that he's a part of. So Burton had made a name for himself before ever hitting the big screen with a number of short films he had done for various studios. Burton had actually begun making films as of the age of 13, with his first film being titled The Island of Dr. Agor. It was a short film where it was actually animated. At the age of 13, he was making animated films. It wasn't until 1982 when he made his first live-action short film, which was titled Luau. Now, at this time, Tim Burton was actually working with Disney. So while he was working with Disney, they had just done, like, The Black Cauldron. They had just done a bunch of those types of films. So he had actually gathered together some of the people who were working with Disney, and he decided that he wanted to make a short film. So he created Luau, a spoof of 50s and 60s B-movies about a group of beach bums who are hosting, you guessed it, a luau.
Shocker.
Really?
I am so surprised.
That took a turn.
Yeah, it did. The ridiculous usage of cheap gags and stereotypes didn't make this a very popular film, but alongside co-director Jerry Rees, Burton decided to let it all hang loose. So I've seen this short film, and it is extremely stereotypical as far as what kind of the mindsets were during the 50s and 60s. You know, there wasn't a lot of cohesion amongst a bunch of different types of colored actors and whatnot, so the different dynamics of integrating people of all different types and backgrounds, it does make for a really awkward interaction in the film. And who would
think that was part of his point?
I don't know. I really don't. It's only a 30-minute spoof, and it doesn't.
It's 30 minutes?
It's 30 minutes.
This thing is 30 minutes.
It was 30 minutes long. So the plot of the film is this. These guys who are on the beach are surfing and whatnot and get called away from the beach and are told by this girl who called them away, told them that she wants to introduce them to an exchange student that is staying at her house for the summer, and her name is Princess Yamakoshi, I believe.
Okay.
And so they decide that the best way to celebrate the arrival of their new Japanese friend would be to host a luau, and it just kind of tumbles apart from there.
What?
There's several horrible moments of just bad stuff, not like gratuitous or anything, but just like mishearing certain words from Princess Yamakoshi as a stereotypical person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. I pick up where you're going, but
yeah.
I mean, in all honesty, sometimes you learn more from your failures than from your successes.
You know what? I'm pretty sure he had a lot to learn, because it seemed like it was filmed on a Super 8 camera, so it was super grainy. The film was horribly synced with it, so audio was sometimes off at times. Mm. It was horribly edited. And I'm pretty sure, like I said, it was a spoof, so it was meant to look like all that kind of stuff. But one of the things I want to note is having this as kind of your launching point, so to speak, for people to look back and say, oh, this is where you started. Let's watch this. I don't know if that was such a right decision.
Yeah, it might not get him noticed today in today's market, but apparently something worked.
Well, it gets worse, because he did another short film shortly after that, but it's for the Disney Channel.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. I try. It was a Disney TV film, TV movie about Hansel and Gretel. But it was just as equally creepy, because they used an entire Asian cast for the film. They were filming on a soundstage. Everything was very like one-dimensional as far as the set pieces. So trees were obviously like boards, and it was very noticeable that they were just a board. And the stepmom and the evil witch were both played by male actors. And
how very Shakespearean.
Yes.
Right.
Like Elizabethan performance. I wonder though, I mean, he's always, from what I've seen, I haven't gone back this far into the archives, but he's always had such a distinctive visual style that I wonder if this wasn't more of a, almost like a performance art kind of attempt on his part, or it was just a really low budget and all they could do were one-dimensional trees.
I would be sad if that's what, like, I had to work with, if they're like, oh, okay, yeah, you can do this, but Yeah, everything that you can put on a piece of cardboard, that'll be your set. Like anything you can paint here, just go ahead and do that. I would feel sad. I mean, think about it. If someone went to you, Hannah, and said, okay, we want you to make an album, but the only instruments you can use are this kazoo and a tambourine. How would you feel about that?
You become real good at beatboxing.
Better yet, a harp made out of rubber bands.
Hey, you work with what you got. And it's honestly not about, because I struggle with this all the time, mm-hmm. and with photography and music and different things like that. When I can't afford the fancy equipment, mm-hmm. But I work towards that. But in the meantime, you work with what you got and you use it to the best of your ability and you become really great, or you try to become really great with those tools that you do have, because it's not about the equipment that you have, it's about the perspective that you have. If you are able to bring your unique perspective and circumstances and way of looking at the world into your craft, that can change everything, because even someone with a Super 8 camera can make a film that will impact lives or make people use their imagination if it's done well and if it tells the story properly. It's story over equipment every single time. It's perspective over equipment every single time.
True. And you know what? I'm pretty sure that's what probably ended up happening, because soon after those films, Burton would eventually strike gold with the likes of Paul Reubens in Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 1985. This actually being his directorial debut. So Pee-wee Herman, played by Paul Reubens, is an eccentric, childlike man who loves his red bicycle and will not sell it to his envious neighbor, Francis. While Pee-wee visits his friend Dottie, the bike is stolen. Thinking his bike is at the Alamo, Pee-wee sets off on a trip where he meets many remarkable people, including waitress Simone and a motorcycle gang. Eventually, chaos ensues, and he ends up finding it at the end. He gets a movie made about him and everything. I really enjoyed this film as a kid. I actually saw this when I was young. And my dad really, he liked the film, so he actually bought it on VHS, and we had seen it a lot. And then moving to San Antonio, you love it even more, because apparently there's a bike somewhere in the basement in the Alamo. And it was a running gag for everybody at the Alamo that worked there. It was fun for me.
I believe you. So what some listeners probably don't know is that you're from Texas.
I am from San Antonio, home of the Alamo, so... every time we would go and visit, the teachers would make the joke like, oh, and hope nobody finds the bicycle in the basement. And I'll be the only dork that's
hashtag
laughing.
Hashtag relevant.
Like, I'll be the only dork that's like actually laughing, fourth grader at a field trip, like, oh, that's a good one.
Everyone's I'm pretty like, sure you found it. A way to talk about the Alamo on every episode I've been on.
I would probably, you know what?
Actually, that's true.
Yeah. You know
that's
what?
That's true.
It's funny because we were watching
that's
a TV
awkward,
show yesterday.
True.
A quick side note, we were watching a TV show yesterday, and I'm somewhat interested in it. It seemed pretty interesting here and there, and then they show the
Timeless on NBC.
NBC, and they showed next week's episode or clip from next week, and they end up going back in time to the Alamo, and I'm like, I'm staying awake for that. I will watch that show. That has my
just
attention
because
now.
Of the Alamo.
Just because of the Alamo.
No, that's not true. It happened when there was a romantic moment between two characters.
I didn't care about that.
They had mentioned the Alamo like the seven times before he said, I'm staying up to watch this.
Anyway.
The truth comes
it wasn't
out.
Until the eyes locked.
Yes.
Yes.
That
the
moment.
Confession
you got
was
me.
Made.
The woman who looks like an anorexic, what's
don't
her name?
Judge people.
Wow.
She looks
don't
like, what's
people.
Her name? Who's the woman who plays Peggy Carter?
We are so far off the reservation now. Her name is Haley Atwell.
Yes,
the woman who plays Peggy Carter.
Yes.
And the woman that you're talking about, I do not remember her name.
Neither do I.
Anyway, she's from that very popular show Rectify.
There you go. Well, going back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure, this would actually also indicate the first time that Burton would enlist the help of composer Danny Elfman. And pretty much begin the relationship that they would have from here on out. Elfman would make his mark in several of Burton's films, including 1988's Beetlejuice, his tale of a recently deceased couple who become ghosts and contract the services of a bioexorcist in order to remove the obnoxious new owners of their house. His largest contributions, however, to Burton's films would come in the next years as Burton's cult classics would be released in theater. One of the unique things about Tim Burton is it's very true. It seems like you when you hear the name Tim Burton, usually his pieces are collaborated with the likes of Danny Elfman. And one of the great things about today's show is that Hannah has actually done scores and composition work for film. So she actually has experience in here. And we were talking earlier, and I was asking her, you know, in regards to Danny Elfman, what is it that separates Danny Elfman from a lot of other composers?
Well, Danny Elfman, he is one of those composers that when you listen to him, it's just, it's pretty much purely magical. Mm-hmm. As far as it's very...
it's like a whimsical type
of
sound.
Yes, it's very ethereal. It's very whimsical. He does a lot of extended builds mm-hmm. that keep you in suspense. And, you know, he is equally what you would think of when Peter Pan is flying through the sky, that very whimsical, happy, fun, I can fly type music. Mm-hmm. But the other side of the coin for him is he does a lot of kind of darker, more twisted pieces that really are highlighted in Tim Burton's films. And he's known for kind of those two things pretty significantly. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really stray too much from either of them. He's definitely done films that are different, doing rock compositions and stuff like that. But he does a lot of very magical, whimsical, but also kind of tortured heart type scores and compositions.
Which is a perfect match for somebody like Tim Burton.
Very
I was
going to
say, it seems like Danny Elfman had pretty much, because I'm not too much familiar with anything prior to Beetlejuice and Pee-wee's Big Adventure as far as Danny Elfman's work. But once he kind of made that break within Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure, it seems like Danny Elfman may have been like a godsend to Tim Burton, because can you imagine anybody else, any other composer that could fit as well as somebody like Danny Elfman next to Tim Burton when it comes to making his films?
I think they would have been very different films in that regard. I love Hans Zimmer, and mm-hmm. he has a really amazing knack and ability to get into the heart and soul of the movie mm-hmm. and the characters and kind of lives and breathes through it. And one of my favorite compositions is the Sherlock Holmes with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law. And Hans Zimmer does an amazing job with that. And it's something very different and very unique. But when I was trying to kind of compare Zimmer with Elfman, I was thinking about Tim Burton's films, and I think it just would have been very different. It would have had a different feel and a different vibe, because in every one of Tim Burton's movies, there is some aspect of that ethereal, magical quality, and Elfman can just do it better. He just has that, you know, kind of Disney feel, while still very much being kind of the Halloween haunted house type as well. And he just, I think he would do it better than most any other people. And he knows the head of Tim Burton, and that is the biggest key. It's like he is the Johnny Depp or the Helena Bonham Carter to Tim Burton's movies for music.
That's true. You could pretty much throw on a CD of all of Danny Elfman's compositions and play it at any Halloween party, and it'll fit. Just
most
in my
of the
mind.
Time, yeah.
Yep.
Chad, what about you? I know you're really big on composers when it comes to films, and when it comes to when you hear a good composition, you tentatively actually buy the soundtrack.
I oftentimes buy soundtracks. It's true.
And what do you think about Danny Elfman? Do you think that he could have been, like, do you honestly think that there could have been anybody who would fit just as well? Or do you think that would have, like Hannah said, changed the entire structure of Burton's films?
Well, I think it's interesting. Composition typically happens once filming is already nearly complete.
Mm-hmm.
They'll get like dailies footage and kind of start building their compositions to that. So the director's vision, ideally, the director's vision is already set. And what the director is visually and with pacing and lighting and all of the sound effects and whatnot, all of that is already in motion by the time the composer takes it on. So that individual or group has a pretty tall order to match that vision musically, and they have, like, the scenes are only as long as the footage lasts,
mm-hmm.
you know, the cut together edited footage. So there's a lot of dynamic. There's just it's a big dynamic for a composer to try to get the right mood setting piece at the right length of time with the swells and the ebbing and the flowing in the right moments within the scenes, and is it action or drama or what, you know? So I think that number one, Danny Elfman is perceptive and good, like Hannah was mentioning, good at really catching the vision that Tim Burton has mm-hmm. for his films. All great composers have to do that. You don't get to be great if you don't. I mean, unless you're maybe composing for a Michael Bay film and you can just use something you've used before, you know, or, you know, whatever. But and a lot of them do. A lot of movies.
Yes.
I mean, even what was the movie we were at a month ago? And I was sitting there saying, this is from the movie Troy. I don't remember what the movie was anyway.
Yeah,
not important. But, you know, so composers sometimes yeah. will reuse certain
Even
moments
Elfman,
of their own.
He does that a lot.
Pieces, yeah.
In a lot of his different pieces, he uses very, very similar phrasing with his music and even cadence. Very, very string heavy,
mm-hmm.
Especially with those long, kind of tense builds. He does that all the time. He's a sucker for a really long, good build. But so I think, you know, when you've been doing it for so long, you kind of repeat some of your favorite things that you've done in a lot of films. And if it fits, it fits. And, you know, if it's not broken, don't try and fix what's, you know, obviously not broken. So,
yeah.
And he does that a lot in a lot of his different soundtracks. I noticed that as I was kind of going through his body of work. But he does it well, and it's not extremely noticeable like it is in some others where it's like you just copied what you did before.
Yeah.
He is able to put a spin on it and a twist on it, and it's able to be one of the things that I look for in a soundtrack or in a composition with music is, can it be its own powerful voice without anything else, without lyrics, without singers on it or musicians, even if it was just one instrument playing one line, is it able to convey a message and be a part of that story and take you to another place? For me, that's hugely important in what it can do, which is why the Pride and Prejudice soundtrack is one of my, the newer one with Keira Knightley, is one of my favorite of all time. It's an amazing, amazing soundtrack because it's able to do that. It's able to take you to another place with just one line.
Interesting. And honestly, this is pretty much what ends up happening with Burton and Elfman in the following years, because in 1989 through 1992, Burton would end up making three films that would pretty much solidify his status as a cult classic genius. 1989's Batman and 1992's Batman Returns would bring to life one of comic book's most interesting characters to life, creating his iconic look that would permeate into each one of his films thereafter. Batman was one of those films that kind of threw everybody for a loop, because at the time, the only type of Batman that people were aware of was the Adam West Batman,
sure.
and then whatever was Campy. In comic books. Exactly. So if you hadn't really been a fan of reading the comic books at the time, then your idea of Batman was Adam West in, you know, swimming shorts and a surfboard and whatnot.
Sure.
I mean, that was your idea at the time.
Well, and bright colors and goofy bad guys with their henchmen and, you know, not the sinister side, which Batman in the comics, most of his run, he has actually been more in the darker side of that storytelling vein. And Tim Burton was a fantastic fit for bringing that kind of Batman story to life for the first time on the big screen.
That's true. And one thing to notice as far as when it came to Batman specifically, the 1989 Batman, this film kind of set, no pun intended, set the stage for how he would ultimately design most of his set pieces from there on out, because of the large and gothic looking type buildings, the way he would use certain colors, the amount of black he would use in certain scenes. Even in Batman Returns, the blue filters that he would use on the camera to signify certain scenes with villains, as opposed to a lighter white, more white filter that would indicate when he was talking to Batman, or not just Batman, but Bruce Wayne within the Batcave and things of that sort. It seemed like this kind of allowed him to form his ultimate vision for what he would like to do from here on out as far as a filmmaker, in my mind, for live action films.
Yeah, I mean, I think Batman, the first Batman, was sort of a litmus test.
Mm-hmm.
Can the character work as a feature film? And number two, can Burton pull off a feature film with an established, well-known character like Batman? And it did work, even in spite of casting Michael Keaton. Really, I think because of casting Michael Keaton, it was not an expected casting decision.
Yeah.
But then you see the transition into Batman Returns is a lot more Burton, if you will,
mm-hmm.
than the first Batman. Like, the first Batman is sort of like he's, you know, kind of dipping his toes in and sort of showing his hand, and then Batman Returns is like full on Tim Burton.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is where, like we were saying with Danny Elfman, this is where those two collaborated so well that they ended up creating what many fans would run to as the only real Batman theme song, if you think about it, because of the fact that not only was it such a great composition that they created for the film, but Danny Elfman actually had to come back and work with Warner Brothers to create a sustainable opening theme song for the cartoon series.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually all part of the same composition. So if you didn't know, now you know. The more you know. Knowledge is power. So ultimately, this film would, like I said, set the stage for not only Burton's vision for how he wants a film to look, but also how he wants a film to flow.
There comes that word issue again.
Hey, you know, sometimes you just gotta garbledygook.
Sometimes you just flow me.
Exactly. Whatever. Sure. the film ultimately would create a mindset within Burton and allow him to kind of really dive into that mindset of weird and strange while still maintaining a sense of humanity, I guess, in his films. Because right in between those two films is another cult classic that he created, Edward Scissorhands, in 1991. And that film was one of the films that I actually had grown up with as well. I grew up with a lot of films, but this one was another one.
Another thing you say every episode.
I do, but you know what? It's hard to explain. I really love movies and...
No, it's easy to explain. Eddie only wants to talk about movies that he likes.
No, that's never the case. I wish. No, it's... With Edward Scissorhands, it was a very unique film because not many people were doing films that really played on the idea of singling one person out unless it was a type of movie commentary on society or whatnot. You know, it wasn't really a format that a lot of people had used. So you take a film like Edward Scissorhands, which singles out one individual and makes him unique and still beautiful all in the same, but makes him also a monster to the people around him. It was like Tim Burton trying to vamp up Frankenstein, so to speak. Revamp Frankenstein. And I like that mentality. I like the idea of that film. And you see glimpses of the vision that Tim Burton had started with, like we said, in Batman, and the way he structured things, the way he structured buildings, the way he shot scenes, the way he made set pieces. I mean, the entire inside of Edward Scissorhands' actual castle looks like it's straight out of Nightmare Before Christmas. So it's really unique.
Well, I think the thing about Tim Burton as a creator is that he kind of always is for the stuff that he like runs the show start to finish, and it's his vision and it's being realized and whatever. Those kinds of projects like Edward Scissorhands, he has a way of taking something that the general population can probably agree at most times, this is pretty creepy, like the look of it is creepy,
mm-hmm.
I'm a little uncomfortable with maybe the setting or the characters or both. But he's showing you that there is something to appreciate in that setting, in that character's personality. I mean, it is weird, but it's an appreciation of weird.
He's really good at showing the tortured soul and making you like them and making you have feelings for them. when maybe in a different light you wouldn't. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think of them in that way. And it's also kind of the start. I don't know if it's exactly the beginning, but it's more of like the launch of his relationship, film relationship with Johnny Depp.
That's very
and,
true.
And that pairing that kind of goes hand in hand. It's very an iconic pairing. When you think of Johnny Depp, you think of, other than Pirates of the Caribbean, you think of a lot of Tim Burton films. When you think of Tim Burton, you think of Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, you know, people like that that mm-hmm. are just like iconic in his films, and they keep coming back over and over and over again because, again, like Danny Elfman, they get Tim's vision.
Yeah.
And they can get inside of his head, and they can play those tortured souls extremely well mm-hmm. and make you feel things for them, make you love them and hate them at the same time.
It's true.
As you're going on this kind of deep, dark journey with them, whether that's, you know, Sweeney Todd or Edward Scissorhands, or, you know, the list goes on.
Yeah. And even after Edward Scissorhands, after Batman Returns, Burton would go on to create other great and really weird films during the years, such as Ed Wood, which stars Johnny Depp, Mars Attacks, Sleepy Hollow, which stars Johnny Depp, and his iteration of Planet of the Apes. Burton would create a film, though, that was so far from his repertoire that it would actually astound audiences all over. 2003's Big Fish would come out as a silent but triumphant film that rose Burton to a whole other echelon. This is actually a film that Chad holds really close to his heart. He's actually a very big fan of this film.
Huge fan of this movie. Yeah, it's... Well, and honestly, when it first came out, I had no idea it was Tim Burton in the director's chair.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, then it's kind of obvious. You know, some of the ways that the characters are made visually, the way the characters appear or some of the settings, you're like, oh, yeah, well, that looks kind of, you know, classic Burton. But the type of story that it was so different and really astounding. There's a benefit there in that it was based on a short story, I believe, or maybe it was a full novel. But, you know, so the substance, the material existed, and this film is an adaptation of it. But, yeah, it's got that kind of ethereal... I mean, it's like it's a fable. It's a real-ish world, but not the real world. You've got a place where time doesn't really pass. You've got... You know, a forest of dead trees where you can get, you know, caught up in. There's a giant. There are, you know, and but then what the beautiful thing about the movie, and I think that this is why it was such a moment for people to say, oh, wow, this is Tim Burton, is because this is Tim Burton. You see both the imagined characters and atmosphere. And as the movie plays out, you also see the real people that inspired these stories that this traveling salesman told his son while he was growing up. And so the son, once he's full grown, he gets to meet all the people that inspired these fantastical, imaginative creations. And you're sitting there kind of thinking, oh, that's like Tim Burton. Like he creates this imaginative, darkly imaginative, but imaginative world so that we can see something very human in all of it, you know, that maybe we wouldn't see if you just said, you know, two guys walk into a bar, one says duck, you know, the third one ducks or whatever. And you it's very basic and very normal, like regular world normal. But when you elevate it into that realm of the imagination, sometimes you make connections that you wouldn't make otherwise.
Yeah.
And the and Big Fish had like an uncanny ability to make people stop and think about what they just watched. I remember even sitting down and watching it for the first time with some friends, and afterwards everyone was just quiet because they were contemplating what they just took in. And it was a really rich story film, which I thought was really cool and kind of a little bit different for him in some ways, but still very on brand.
Well, in my mind, I think it's completely different from what you're used to seeing with Tim Burton. I mean, this is on the heels. Big Fish is pretty much on the heels of Planet of the Apes, which took a big left turn from the original film and got a lot of people all up in arms. I mean, you're talking after doing Ed Wood, oh my gosh, Mars Attacks, that's another odd one, Sleepy Hollow, and then like we said, Planet of the Apes, to jump in from those films and then a couple years later, because I believe Planet of the Apes was 1999, couple years later down the road, come out with a film that would actually speak directly to the hearts of the fans that Tim Burton has, it's kind of like surpassing the very surface of a lot of what people are fans of with him, and dives deeper into that. And I think that may have been one of his most profound movies, honestly, in my opinion. I love a lot of his older works. I love a lot of the things that he's done previously. I like the weird, I like the goofy and all that. But I think the one thing about Big Fish is that I believe it really does mirror the creator's true heart, the creator being Tim Burton. I really think that this is kind of his, like, hey, just in case you never get to know who I am, this is who I am right here. My stories are built upon the people who have built within me.
Well, and it's one of those unique opportunities where he plays in both worlds. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time he's in just a really creative space. It's all make-believe, the whole thing, even when it, you know, somewhat resembles, you know, like in Edward Scissorhands. In the beginning, like, you have sort of the suburban town, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's highly stylized. Like, it's still a caricature. He has a lot of caricature usage in his films. But with Big Fish, you actually had the caricature world and the real world. And you saw both the divisions and the connections between the two, which is pretty unique because he kind of goes so far into the creative world with everything he does, be it live action or stop motion. He's so far down in that realm that you rarely get to see that meeting point between the two.
Yeah. Well, after Big Fish, however, there wasn't much else that could be said about his efforts in live action, marking the filmmaker's downfall in the original live action with his take on the timeless classic Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which I was not a fan of. And I'm pretty sure there are millions of other people who would agree.
Yeah.
I boycotted it. I still haven't seen it.
I can't stand it. Actually, on VGBstudios.com.
Like, yeah, I don't think I would like it either.
VGBstudios.com, there's an article I wrote not too long ago about the 7 reboots that didn't need to be made, and that was the number one. I really didn't like this film. His vision of Alice in Wonderland wouldn't do much in the wow factor for audiences, and Dark Shadows was an immensely disappointing film, scoring only a 37% on Rotten Tomatoes. He would, however, make a comeback with his 2014 live-action film, Big Eyes, about the artist in San Francisco who would get her work taken over by the man that she was dating at the time. And then
good star power in that one, Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz.
Yes. Have any of you guys had a chance to see that one?
Mm-mm. I have not.
We're going to have to put that on the list. And his 2016 film, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, based on the novel of the same name. We haven't had a chance to see that one either, but there is hope still. There was talk about how Miss Peregrine was supposed to be a really great film, and we haven't had a chance to see that one. But I'm my love affair for all the things that Tim Burton comes out with really leaves me to still have hope for whatever he has to come out with in the near future. I'm just hoping that it kind of steers away from things like Dark Shadows and like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
I'm curious if we'll do another stop motion.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I'm not too sure. I know there is talks about, the only thing that I know of is that there is talks about him doing a sequel to Beetlejuice, but that's been in talks for God knows how long. I think for as long as Winona Ryder is alive and Michael Keaton is alive, they will continue to ask that question and bug them both. I mean, they could be doing Shakespeare on Broadway, and they were like, so, do you guys still plan on doing a Beetlejuice 2? So,
yeah, I think that's one of those that it's better to just keep holding out that hope and never realize it. Like, never actually try to do that.
I feel like that would end in major disappointment.
Yeah, I don't think it would work.
Yeah.
Well, that concludes our celebration of the illustrious Tim Burton and Octoburton Fest, but that does just switch us over to our special segment for the month of October, and that is Halloween candy. So obviously, in honor of the Halloween season, we're taking a few minutes out of each episode in October to enjoy a bit of Halloween candy. Each week, we're taking a quick look at some of cinema's most beloved and notorious horror films. This week, we're talking about 1978's Halloween, starring Donald Pleasance and Jamie Lee Curtis. The film itself, so if you're not familiar, Halloween is essentially a film about, on Halloween night in 1963, six-year-old Michael Myers stabs his sister to death. After sitting in a mental hospital for 15 years, Myers escapes and returns to Haddonfield to kill again. Yes, this film is the epitome of what Halloween films are about.
That's something.
It really is. You know, well, it's better than doing... It was funny because the other day we were watching, me and my wife were watching Child's Play, and we realized that Child's Play was around Christmas time. So I'm like, hey, this could be a Christmas movie. So we really kind of got excited about that because I'm like, starting to take notes for future episodes that we're going to have in December. Chadley.
That will never happen.
No.
That will not.
That'd be great.
Not happen.
The film itself is an interesting take as far as on the idea of the indestructible object hitting the immovable force. Because you have somebody like Jamie Lee Curtis, who ultimately became the epitome of Scream Queens, and having her make her directorial debut, or not directorial, acting debut.
I was
in this
say,
film.
She got an upgrade somewhere in here.
With the film was directed by James Carpenter, but the film actually took a lot of its inspiration for their character Michael Myers based off of Westworld, the gunslinger. The idea of somebody who, you know, can't be stopped, is constantly on the move. And seeing as they've made like 7 of these, including a reboot. Two reboots, sorry. There's been 7 of these, as well as a Halloween reboot and a Halloween 2 reboot. It's got some consistency there. I mean, it might be all over the place, but still.
Well, the beautiful thing about most kind of Halloween or horror slasher movie, you know, whatever, they're very low budget. Like, you don't actually require.
I'm shocked that you just put beautiful and horror in the same sentence.
I am too. I am too. I mean, because they're low budget, it's really easy to churn them out every year. The sequels not necessarily are an indication that the movie was wildly popular, but that it made a good profit.
Well,
because it wasn't hard to make a profit.
It's interesting that you say that, because the film was shot on a budget of $300,000, but it grossed over $47 million. Now, using my calculative brain and factoring in inflation, it actually equates to about $170 million that the film grossed over the course of, obviously, some time, making it actually one of the most successful independent films of all time.
Right, I mean, horror movies in general have margins like that. When they are even marginally successful, they have a huge profit margin because they don't take much expense. Don't tend to be... I mean, yeah, you've got your Final Destinations and whatnot that try to do some extra effects that cost more, but yeah, I mean, you've got quite a few that didn't cost a pretty penny to make, but they made a pretty penny.
Yep.
With what they got.
Absolutely.
It's very true. So if you get a chance this Halloween season, right before the 31st, try to get in another horror film there, and you know what, enjoy it, and have a great time. But that wraps up another awesome show that we've had here on the Filmlosophers. And of course, if you have any comments or thoughts, drop us a line on facebook.com/Filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/Filmlosophy101. This was a really fun conversation. I had a really great time, especially seeing the faces turned sour as soon as I talked about Halloween movies and whatnot. That was great. That was awesome. But you know what? We want to thank Hannah for being on the show.
Absolutely.
And
my pleasure.
It's always fun having that third person here. And one thing that I've always recognized with Hannah is Hannah really kind of always adds that unique flair to our conversations.
Thanks.
I'm appreciative that she's here today.
I always enjoy it. It's fun.
Hannah, where can people find you at?
They can find me on
Other
Twitter.
Other than your home.
Don't find me there.
Nope. Not after talking about
don't
Halloween.
Follow me in real life. But follow me on Twitter at HannahPorter11 or on Instagram at HannahPorterMusic.
Tis true. And of course, if you want to catch all our previous episodes, you can go to VGBstudios.com and you can catch all our previous episodes, as well as other episodes of the Video Game Bang crew and me, Mike Self, and I. I said that right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Me, Mike Self, and I.
That does it.
With Mike Betancourt. So From all of us here, we had a great time tonight, and we wish that you would have a safe and wonderful Halloween this upcoming Monday.
Don't get too much candy.
Don't get too much candy. And
it'll make you feel bloated.
Although, if you want to send us candy, we're more than open for you to send us candy.
Taking donations.
I'll take donations. Shoot. Corey will share it with us. Fly on the Wall is here today, and he'll share the candy with us. But all of us, from all of us here at the Film Lossers, my name's Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.